Succession number 28699, Reel 6.
Yeah, you've just landed on D-Day. You're talking about the first casualty. Was there any incoming fire from the Germans?
Very little, very little. We hardly got anything there the first few hours. And we halted and waited before we moved on again about half past four in the morning, I think. Anyway, one interesting thing was one officer, who's obviously not alive now anyway, but his, he was in command of a support company, smashing that fella, great ladies' man. And he came up on his motorbike to where we were stopped. He'd had the motorbike on his platoons, different things. And he said, "Well, I think I've created a record." I said, "What?" He said, "I was riding up there past this farmhouse and this young girl waved to me and I went over." So he said, "I think I have had the first shag on D-Day."
So, do you remember his name?
Brian. Brian was his first name. But to stay with him, just advance a little bit, when we went into Brussels, we went through Brussels and we stopped. Nobody was allowed back into Brussels. But Brian took a jeep. And he came back the next morning on a tram, covered in lipstick, and he'd spent the night in Brussels, you see. What he didn't know was during the night, the colonel had had three O groups, and I attended his place. And the first one I said, "Oh, he was out with the anti-tank platoon." The second one I said, he'd just gone off to see the mortar platoon. And the third one, the colonel said, "Don't tell me any more bloody lies. Just tell him he's going to see me when he arrives." Well, we were supposed to be moving off at whatever it was, 7:30 or something. And Brian arrives, happy as a lark, just getting over the booze, covered in lipstick. Every woman on the tram or bus kissed him, on the tram kissed him. And I said, I told him. He said, "What?" I said, "We're moving in 10 minutes. And we've had three O groups and you haven't been at any." He said, "I've lost the jeep." So I don't understand why, but he went up to see John Mogg, Colonel Mogg, and he sent him back to Brussels to find his jeep with somebody driving him there, instead of being court-martialed. So he went back, and he told me later, within 5 minutes he found his jeep, which the military police had, and he spent the next 5 hours in Brussels, living it up, and then came back and said he'd been very lucky and he'd found the jeep. And nothing happened.
What was his surname? Your name was Brian.
Oh, I've forgotten now.
When you landed, the commanding officer was Humphrey Woods.
That's right.
What was he like?
Well, he was a real sort of gung-ho type. When he was killed, he was sitting on the top of his Ben carrier. And it was all... When I first arrived, there was all kinds going on in the mess, and he was doing all the things of putting the booze on his head and singing and all. He was only 27, I think, and he was a real go-getter. But I used to say later, I said, if he hadn't been killed at Longyearbyen, he'd have been killed the week after, because he was going to get killed, no doubt. I think he was 27, he'd already got... I don't know, MC, DSO or something. I know he got the DSO or the MC going into a tank lager in the desert and blowing up tanks because he was a bit bored, there was nothing to do. So he and somebody else went in and blew two or three tanks up. So
we've got you on your first day, your first night in France. You say you obviously you were resting somewhere, or at least you were dug in somewhere.
Yes, so then we moved on. To the Bayeux Road.
Did you come under attack that night, do you recall?
No. We went onto the Bayeux Road, and we dug in on the Bayeux Road. And the main thing there was to try and stop the fellas getting drunk on the booze that that was there. Everybody, somebody found this cellar or whatever it was. So, and me and the sergeant going around saying, smash that bottle, smash that bottle. And, but really nothing much happened. And
had you met any French civilians by now?
Yes, just the odd one.
How were they?
Well, they weren't that friendly in Normandy, because I think they'd been, they hadn't had a bad life with the Germans, because they were away from all the main things, and the Germans, wanted all their produce, so they had not a bad time, really, under the Germans. So when we were bombarding them and blowing up their cattle and things, I don't think they were that friendly. When we got into the towns, then they were a different sort of people. I mean, there was one I remember, though. He produced a bottle of Calvados, which he kept hidden for D-Day, for a liberation day. We knocked that back with him. But on the whole, they were very quiet. They weren't enthusiastic at all. Not like, say, Brussels, where everybody was waving flags, kissing you, and throwing flowers, and.
So you had no real contact with the enemy at this point in time?
Not really. Just the odd thing, But I didn't have any casualties then, on that first day at all. I don't think the battalion had many. And it was more or less sending out patrols and things, finding out where anybody was, where the enemy were.
Did you have to take patrols? Were you taking any patrols out?
Oh, I did, yes, then. But later on...
You've described the numbers of people and how you've kind of worked with them, but it must have been a pretty hair-raising experience, because you are in the unknown, aren't you?
Well, after Langevin, I did five fighting patrols in 8 nights.
What's the purpose of a fighting patrol?
It's to try and capture somebody, and you expect to go in and have a fight, whereas the only patrol was to go and find out what was there. But
that would be the reconnaissance.
But the fighting patrol was because you thought somebody was there, so you went in to fire and attack and maybe get a prisoner.
Were there men in the platoon who you might say were good patrolmen and others that
yes.
you would be?
Well, more or less, they're pretty well all okay. There was one big corporal, and I would never take him because he made too much noise. He really sounded like a hair development on his own. Big, clumsy lad. But on one occasion, when I did a patrol with, two officers were on it, and we were pinned down by a machine gun, and my other platoon behind me, a section behind me, had an open fire, and I'll talk about that later, but on that occasion, I said to him, we couldn't get through the hedge, you see, behind us. I said to him, when we start firing, get through that bloody hedge. And we finally just hurled himself and knocked the bush right down, and everybody was able to get out. But on an ordinary patrol, I would never have taken him. Now, I mentioned the corporal, Pierre Chauden. At that time, when I had to do all the patrolling, I think I was the only officer, I was probably the only subaltern left at that juncture. And so I said to Major Rumble, who volunteered me, I think. Anyway, I said, well, I'm not taking my own platoon all the time. I have to go, I can't argue, but I'll take sections from other platoons and other NCOs. So Pierre Chauden, Corporal Pierre Chauden, said to me, what's this about you taking other people on platoon? I said, because I'm not taking my own platoon all the time, and I'll take other NCOs as well. He said, wait a minute, have you got that watch? Well, I had a beautiful watch my father had bought me, which was oval, and you pulled it and the watch came out. It was quite expensive. And so I said, yes. He said, well, I'm coming then. Nobody's having that. I'll have that off your body before you're cold. So I said, oh, sorry. He said, I'm coming. I don't care who else is going, but I'm going to be on all the patrols. Which was, I suppose, nice. It was a great way of saying he's going to be with me all the time, you know. But when we were doing a patrol, he'd creep up and say, have you got the watch? And I'd say, shut off, you stupid. He was a great fella. And I promoted him to sergeant, my platoon sergeant, the infantry platoon. And then eventually he was commissioned. He was a great lad. But I've never forgotten that. Two things about all the others are dead. And then this thing of, I'll have that off your body before you're dead. That watch.
Was there an attitude amongst your platoon that you were being called too often? You know, with a grumbling occasion saying, oh, what else again?
Well, I felt it. But as I say, like with that, the trolling, I took another section every time, except my own, because I didn't think it was fair. But what could I do? I mean, I remember at that time doing a patrol and taking a Canadian officer under instruction. I think I'd been there 3 weeks, so I was a veteran. And I was now supposed to teach this Canadian how to do a patrol. And I thought was a wonderful story, which I eventually told the colonel. We started off, and there's one fellow with me, a sniper he used to be, and he's with me, and we hear footsteps. And we've whispered, there's about five or six men. And then we had a clink of metal, to put a machine gun in the bushes, and we had a cough. So the others get up, and we lined them up along this little bank. And I said, now, as soon as I throw a grenade, we open fire. Then I throw another grenade, and we stop and go in, which I did. And a pig ran out, and we hadn't even killed it. So we carried on. And then there's a house, little cottage thing, and I saw this light. So I'm just setting up the same thing, and I said, wait a minute, and I walked forward, and it was a glow worm in the bottom of the door. I then walked further on, and I'm in front on the left, Canadians on the right, and a cat shot across me, frightened the life out of me, and I dived into the ditch. And as I did, I saw on just around this door a German on his knees, or one knee, firing a gun, which is a flame all around the Tommy gun or whatever it was. And I was in the ditch. So we ran back, and I said, that's it. And the captain said, oh, wait a minute, I think I've dropped my revolver. I said, well, you're on your own, mate. I said, within the next minute, they're going to have mortars everywhere. I said, they know where we are in Berlin now. We've fired enough rounds. And this fella has got to have his position known, and they'll drop mortars. Anyway, we got about 50 yards, 100 yards back, and the mortars all started coming down. So I reported to John Mogg. He said, what happened? I said, well, I can give you the bearing on two or three mortars groups. Other than that, we put in an unsuccessful attack on a pig and a glowworm. See? So, and the end of this thing was, a couple of days later, we're moving forward. We're walking up the road, because the Germans have gone. And there's some pioneers there. And I said, what are you checking? And one said, oh, this ditch is full of mines. And I walked forward, sort of sweat trickling down my back, think, that's where I dived, to get away from the cat.
In command of a patrol, out in no man's land, for want of a better term, are the signals hand signals, or are you able to give...
Well, no, because it's mostly at night, you see, those fighting patrols.
You have to speak of it.
Yes, whispered. But, I mean, that's why I say I used to take one fellow ahead, and then they'd catch up with us and whisper instructions. But patrolling was very nerve-wracking. It was, because, you know, you're out there, you don't know what's in front, and it's pitch dark, and, you know, think there's German behind every bush and every tree. So it was a bit wearing on the nerves, that. And when I had to do, as I say, 5 and 8 nights, I thought I was pretty near being shattered. Fortunately, we got lots of other people, so I didn't have to do them so often.
So you moved across the Bayeux Road the following day of the landing, and where did you go then? What happened next?
Well, we just advanced up the road a few miles because the Germans had cleared out. And that's when I saw these pioneers with the mine detectors. And, you know, as I said, they said, this ditch is full of mines. And I thought, how lucky can you be? The cat? And they dive in the ditch, otherwise I'd have walked straight into this German. And then I dived in the ditch, we didn't hit the mine.
So after a few days, you came to the first big battle.
Yes, the Langeve.
Do you recall what happened immediately prior to that? You were coming, obviously, advancing towards the...
Well, up till then, it was kind of... you know, you met opposition, you fired, you got through. It was country that helped them much more than us.
Can you describe the country you were going through?
Well, the Bocage country, they called it. It was hedges. You'd have hedges, some quite high. So you're really walking along roads, and there could be people anywhere, you know. And so it was a great place to defend and a lousy place to attack, and this most of the way this was like this, and then you'd get a bit of open ground, but again you know, you're just walking blind until somebody opened fire and then you took action. But it was the fact that they were initiating everything that was the problem, and that's why everybody felt nervous, because we're walking along and we go on until somebody shoots at us. And this is why I said you had to go in front, because, you know, otherwise you'd be pushing somebody in front and you'd have to keep coming up and saying, go on, keep going. But if they saw you, there's nothing, they had to go.
So the Germans would be making use of every hedgerow.
That's right. Yeah.
And farm buildings, were they being...
Yes,
fortified?
Everything. And, I mean, that we had, you know, we'd had casualties before Langeve, and we had many more after. And the turnover was pretty horrific amongst, you know, the troops. This is why you didn't really get to know so many people well, because they didn't last that long, you know. And it's a very strange thing. But I never thought of being killed. Everybody else seemed to be getting killed. But I don't know. You had this strange feeling that I'm going to get there.
But can you describe the Langeve position before you prior to going in?
Well, I think the thing about Langeve was that the colonel... Wood had seen the brigadier the night before, and said, you know, if we attack in daylight, we're going to have very heavy casualties. We should do it at night and with more reconnaissance. And the brigadier, who had been told what he had to do, said it had to be done in the daytime. And Wood was correct. We had heavy, terrific casualties, including Colonel Wood. And we started, it was cornfields, and in my company, well, we had B and C, B, A and B companies, I think, were in on the left, and C and D on the right. Now, A and B went ahead, and the first thing was B Company apparently did a lot of reconnaissance the night before and had a lot of casualties. A company went in and lost all their officers. I think B company, practically all the officers, but A company lost all of them. We're walking through these cornfields, and then on their side, about the last 60 yards or something, they'd cut the cornfield. And the Germans were lying in slit trenches with strings on the machine guns, which are all lined up. And they just pulled them and mowed everybody down. Now, C Company had a few casualties, so D Company came through them. Now, the other two platoon leaders in D Company were both killed. And we had other casualties. But Major Rumble and the captain and I were still alive. So we, C Company had had casualties, we got through, and then we had to put the platoon out, you see, or platoons. So I had my platoon down by some hedgerows, and the runner had just come back from the sergeant, from the one of the corporals, to report to me that they were all in position. And I'm kneeling down on one knee, and he's standing in front of me, and these tanks came round and opened fire. Well, they killed the runner. The sergeant was about 10 yards behind, and they blew his head off. Shells landed where we were. They killed the runner, and the shells landed there. And we dived through the hedgerow, the Piat men and me, and what. And my feeling then was, I hope to God I'm not blind, because all this blast and muck had come in. Anyway, I opened my eyes, and I was delighted to think I could see. And then after a minute or so, I crawled back through the hedge to get the Piat, which is all smashed up. So I come back, and then somebody comes up and says, Rumble wants to see you, Major Rumble. So I said, right, go and join the other lads in the hedgerows, and if infantry comes, we've got a fight. And the tanks are still there. So I go back, and Rumble says, the colonel wants a patrol. I want somebody to go and find the other companies and the 8th Battalion. I said, well, my sergeant's been killed. He said, well, you're the only officer, the other two officers have been killed. You'll have to go. I thought, well, you could have sent your second in command, but anyway. So I get one fella, and we go off. The first thing we did was pass where A and B companies had been, and there were just bodies everywhere. And nobody seemed to have survived at all. And we're going along, and we came across what was a tank crew brewing up, German tank crew. And we came on this little trail, and they jumped up and ran back to their tank. We ran this way, because they probably thought we were the first two of a battalion. Anyway, I finally got to B Company, and the colonel there, I reported to him. He said, what's the situation? And I told him, and he said, well, what about you? What's your platoon? I said, well, the sergeant's been killed, and the other two officers been killed, and my corporal's in charge. He said, what the hell are you doing here? I said, well, I've got two pips. The fellow who told me to come here has got a crown. So I've come. He said, well, who's your company commander? I said, Major Rumble. He said, oh, Christ, shambles. I slung him out of my battalion. Get back, son, as soon as you can. So I come back, and my platoon are coming out, led by this corporal. So I stopped them, and I said, what are you doing? He said, we've been told to withdraw. I said, no, we're not withdrawing. Get back. And I made him go back to the hedgerows. And I went up, and I said to Shambles, we all called him Shambles, remember? I said, what the hell's going on? He said, I told him to withdraw to there. I said, they're just there to say withdraw. They were going. Anyway, we got some tanks up. John Mugg, I think, destroyed one of the tanks. Their tank, you know.
Was he in command by now?
Yeah, yes, because Wood had been killed. And he'd asked for a patrol, you see. Somebody to go and meet the 8th and see what the situation was. And, of course, Rumble sent me. Anyway, eventually, that night, we were pulled out. But I think, according to Rumble, according to John Mogg, we lost virtually half the battalion. We lost 22 officers, I think, and 200 odd men.
Were you in the village by now? Had you got into the village?
We got in, yes. And then, well, as I said, I think it was Gloucester's who relieved us, or something. I'm not sure.
Did you have tank support? Were there some tanks with
you? There were some tanks came up. First, they didn't want to know, you know, because they knew they'd got no chance, outgunned. But eventually, they did manoeuvre and start firing at the German tanks. I don't know what they did. The German tanks withdrew, so that they achieved that because there had no German infantry. There were just the tanks, which is unheard of, attacking with no infantry. Fortunately, there was no infantry because we'd have had it. But as I say, then the next that night.